Hello and welcome to this special Easter weekend edition of Harmonious World. My name is Hilary Seabrook, and a couple of weeks ago I went to Cambridge to interview the sax player you're listening to right now, Tim Boniface, who is also chaplain at Girton College. I heard Tim playing his Psalter Themes for Peace at St Albans Abbey a few weeks ago, and you can read my review of that gig on my blog. Tim's album The Eight Words from 2016 features a jazz suite based on the eight sayings of Jesus in the Passion According to St John. And this beautiful track that you're listening to is The Second Word, which takes as its inspiration John chapter 18 verse 11, put your sword back in its sheath, am I not to drink the cup that the Father has given me? Tim and I had a lovely conversation in his study at Girton College in Cambridge, and I hope you enjoy listening into our chat. Welcome to Harmonious World, Tim Boniface, sax player and chaplain here at Girton College.
Thank you. It's really, really good to join.
Lovely. So I want to talk to you about everything, but specifically I want to talk to you about Psalter, which is how I last saw you and heard you play, which was at St Albans Abbey. So should we start with that?
Great. Yeah.
So tell me about the suite, how it came about, because it's got a very specific meaning behind it.
Yes, so Psalter is a six-part jazz suite that picks up six verses in the Book of Psalms, which include the word peace. And it goes through quite a range of what peace can mean, whether it's peaceful, restful sleep, whether it's peace from war, whether it's inner peace. Also, peace is injustice. People can hold their peace and ignore the cries of those who are suffering. And the suite tries to get under the skin of those texts a little bit from my perspective and explore them with an instrumental set of compositions, but then opening them out for people's own consideration. So part of what's going on is me being interested in the way music can help us to meet texts and explore them without giving them a final kind of sealed meaning. So what we did at St Albans Cathedral was we performed this suite, and the idea was that the audience had a chance to get into the text and explore them for themselves as they experience the improvising musicians exploring the texts for themselves too. It came about because a friend of mine contacted me knowing that I'd written two suites like this before, one based on the Passion in St John and the other one based on the Christmas story. She works at St Albans Cathedral, and she said, we've got this great exhibition on peace called Peace Doves, which is an installation by the sculptor Peter Walker, which you would have seen. He hangs thousands of paper doves from the ceiling of the cathedral, and they've all got messages of peace written on by members of the community that are garnered over the weeks leading up to the installation. It's lit very beautifully, and they wanted a jazz element to the programme that they were having as that installation was installed. So she rang me, I think, around this time last year and said, could you come and do a concert? And I thought, yeah, we could do a concert, but why not write something new? Is this an opportunity, an invitation to the new, to a new one to add to these other two that I'd already done? So that's how it came about. And then I contacted, I think, the three musicians who I felt I really wanted to explore this with. So James Pearson on the piano, Malcolm Crease on the double bass, and John Ormston on the drums, each of whom are astonishing musicians. And I wrote that then over the course of the summer. And some pieces come very quickly, and some take ages. Some you spend a long time digging under the skin of something and you don't know what's coming out and then suddenly it clicks. Other ones, they just arrive, really. So we then performed that in St Albans Cathedral in January, which was a really, really beautiful evening, actually. I mean, it was quite moving to do. There were a lot of people there and it felt very special and hopefully the opening of something else.
Yeah, and it was spectacular musically and visually for being in the cathedral underneath that fabulous installation of all of those peace doves, particularly at a time when we were all thinking about the upcoming second anniversary of Ukraine's invasion. Sure. And then also the everything that's going on in Gaza.
Yes.
And it was just chilling in a good way. As a member of the audience, it was amazing. And those, as you say, those guys are just spectacular.
I mean, I suppose when I wrote it over the summer, I had no idea how horribly the intensity of a suite on peace would increase. You know, so we performed in January. Everything having kicked off in Israel and Gaza in October. So that was sort of felt right to do, but also. It felt kind of presumptuous to think that in any way I could play or speak anything into that kind of story or that way that we're all thinking together, hopefully, about that. But perhaps perhaps doing music, non-verbal music, you know, instrumental music, was a good way of expressing something in this time.
Yes, and I think the idea that you talked about encouraging the audience to think, and that's all any of us can do really at the moment, isn't it, about think about peace and think about what's going on.
There's some other things we can do probably as well, but it is important to start with actually recognizing what kind of world we're in, and I think the creative arts can open up that space for us, for our imaginations to move towards the various ways in which we can act and support and all sorts of things.
Right. How did you select the texts, first of all? Because there were six sort of fairly short, sort of one or two sentence long extracts. How did you select those? Did you read the whole of the Psalms and find that, you know, and how did you choose?
Well, I can't remember whether you said at the beginning, but I'm also a priest in the Church of England. I'm the chaplain here at Girton College, where we're sat looking over this gorgeous lawn. So I read Psalms every day because they come up in daily prayer. So the Psalms are a part of my daily rhythm. And I used the translation of the Psalms that is in the back of the Church of England's Common Worship Daily Prayer Book. And there are some verses on peace that are very well known and some aren't. And I just worked with a concordance to make sure I wasn't missing any and had a look through. What I really wanted to avoid, both for artistic and kind of theological reasons, I guess, was six or seven verses that were all quite samey. You know, we all want peace. Because in a way, what could end up is you end up with something quite... not bland, but without enough undulation in the landscape, right? So I really wanted to select six texts that all pressed into peace in a different kind of way. And as I say, we have everything from the Lord will give his people the blessing of peace, which is comes in a very strong psalm. So the idea is there's something really, really strong and authoritative being given, through to in peace I will lie down and sleep. So, you know, a daily kind of peaceful rest that we all hope for, through to, as I said, verses that are about not holding one's peace at the tears of the suffering.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, why aren't you listening to my cry thing? Do not hold your peace at my tears. And peace is a deception, so those who speak peace but have malice in their hearts. So that's how I selected the text, to give us a good range. And also a couple of really hopeful texts as well, which is where the suite ends up.
Yes, it definitely does. It definitely left everybody feeling uplifted and as you say, hopeful, rather than, you know, distraught about the state of the world, I think.
Yeah, we're invited to consider those together and not to do an either or. And so that was what, you know, another thing that was going on was to say, you know, I didn't want to write a suite that was going into one or other of those spaces, but that was really trying to occupy them in the same kind of soundscape, in the same place. And one of the things that's really important in how I try and write these and how we try to perform them is they are very much contextual. So they're about where we're performing it and who we're performing it to and how they're responding and what the acoustics are like and what the visual setting's like. So jazz is great for that because you do always play it differently every time. But the array of ways in which we've performed some of my other stuff and the variation can be absolutely huge.
Yeah, and it does feel incredibly special, and I'm so glad I was there for that event because it wasn't recorded, it's not, you know, you can't find it anywhere. And hopefully at some point in the future it will be...
It would be nice.
You know, yeah, it would be nice to get that.
If there are any patrons out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you think of the lack of money in the arts and the money that's elsewhere, you know, it would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be good.
But there we go. Right, so tell me how you ended up here. So we're in your beautiful office, your beautiful study in Girton College, and you're wearing a dog collar. And when I saw you, you were wearing, and in fact, a moment ago, you were wearing a saxophone sling.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, those trappings. How have you ended up here?
In the short term, I've ended up here because a friend of mine rang me in 2019 and said, the job at Girton's coming up, you've got to do it. It's absolutely made for you. So I have been a Church of England priest for about 8 years or so. And I was full-time in the church before this. And really started to feel that this whole thing of a dual vocation of being a musician and a priest was absolutely right for me. And Girton is an amazing college. It's a very humane place. It's a very exciting place. It's got an amazing history. It was the first residential higher education institution for women in the UK, and is continuing to ask, you know, what it means to pioneer inclusivity in education. My predecessor is a poet and musician and theologian, so the furrow was ploughed, if you like, for a slightly maverick artistic chaplain. So that's how I've ended up here, and it's great. I mean, I love the job. It's a kind of classic college chaplaincy in some ways, but I push it into some jazz directions on occasion. More long term, I think I've ended up here because I discovered over time that playing music, but jazz particularly, and prayerful life as a Christian are both rooted in the same kind of place. So it took a while to learn, but they're not in competition. They're both me. I'm 100% priest and 100% musician. It's not trying to make space for God and space for jazz. God doesn't need space. It doesn't work like that. So it's not always been a comfortable journey, but I think both the tradition of the Church of England, broadly, notwithstanding issues that we have at the moment, and have always had, and also the tradition of jazz, felt like places where I belonged quite early, you know, around kind of 9, 10, 11.
Okay.
So my grandfather was a priest, and I always felt like, yes, that was a space where I felt comfortable. And vocationally, you sort of discern over time that, okay, I think that might be a place where I'm being invited to be me and to give myself there. And jazz... My dad took me to a jazz concert when I was 11. We might have been to one before, but I remember this one in particular. It was Chris Barber's band in Epsom. And there was a great tenor player called John Crocker, who I don't know if you ever heard of. Fantastic player. Really interesting, because it was kind of, you know, British trad, but he had this really sort of Jazz of the Philharmonic swing kind of voice going on. And
wow.
And I heard him play, I can remember it, I remember where we sat and what it was to see it, just hearing this whole band, it was like hearing a conversation that I just had to be part of. That was it. I got to play this. I can't get enough of listening to this stuff. And so for years, I just used to put on jazz music and play along with it on the saxophone at home. And that's how I learned,
really.
Just playing along with records, joining in the conversation. And so both those conversations, the conversation of the church and the conversation of jazz, have always been really key for me. And yeah, there were points where it felt like a bit of a fight. You know, which direction should I go? And then thankfully, there were enough people around who helped me to discern actually that they're perfectly compatible. I mean, sometimes time is difficult, you know.
Of
you
course.
Play a late gig and you got an early service. It's not great fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's how I've ended up here.
Right. And so did you have training as a sax player?
I did my kind of grades with a great teacher in Surrey, where I lived, who, you know, played in big bands in the 60s and 70s and was, you know, just a good, like, teacher, lovely tone, lovely sound, great articulation, great voice, and he sort of took me through the grades, but he didn't teach me to improvise. That was entirely about playing along with recordings. And then that was it for musical training.
Wow.
So I went to university and studied theology at Exeter, and then with Nottingham University, and then Durham University for later stuff. So academically, I'm a theologian.
Right.
So training, yeah, jazz training's been about just trying to get near as many good jazz musicians as I can and play with them. And then gradually they started coming my way. So that was nice, you know. It sort of felt like you're trying to force your way into this, because then I felt like, space opened up for me to do my thing. But I'm still learning. We're all still learning all the time, right?
Yeah.
It's just where you saturate, but you think you haven't got anything to learn anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I was going to university, there were you couldn't do anything in jazz at all. You could go to one of the music colleges in London. I think Leeds had just started then, and there were big bands, but they were definitely kind of and that's an extra.
Sure.
And there was no certainly you couldn't do a degree in you know, music of anything that was of interest to me, really. Although I was classically trained, I had this whole thing about jazz. Like you say, when you've got the bug, that's it.
Yeah, that is, isn't it?
Yeah, and I find it interesting that you're of a younger generation, but so you've had the same experience that all of my compatriots had, which is we just learned it.
Yeah.
We just listened to it and went, let's have work out.
I do quite a lot of teaching now, and just trying to communicate. If you've decided you need to practice, you know, for an hour over this time, spend half of it listening.
Yeah.
You know, it's not wasted, you've got to do it. And I think there's some really interesting questions around how accessible all the music is now. Which is great in some ways, but also does it mean we listen too broadly, we don't listen specifically? You know, I there's still records that I can put on at home, and I could tell you where every hi-hat goes through the whole 6 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
I can, because I only had a few CDs, so you listen to them a lot and a lot, played along, listened to them obsessively. And I hope that people are still listening like that. For me, that's how I got under the skin of it, really.
Yeah, and I think listening mindfully is something that a lot of people don't do. A lot of people just put Spotify on and let Spotify play whatever Spotify wants.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, there is something about putting a track on and listening to it.
And I mean, interestingly, with the dual vocation hats on, there's something really meaningful about the family resemblance between mindful listening and prayer, meditation. So because of the way music occupies time, so you can't choose for, you know, what have we got, an album here. So this is a Lee Konitz album. So the first one is 13 minutes 48, okay?
Yeah.
There's only three of them. It's Brad Mehldau, Lee Konitz and Charlie Hayden.
Wow.
Great album.
Yeah.
13 minutes. That piece of art, that track, takes 13 minutes.
Yeah.
It can't take any less.
No.
So it's not, you can't... it's like a play, you know, whereas you could choose how long you take to read a book or look at a painting. That's not to detract, it's just different.
Yeah.
But the way music occupies temporal space means you have to take your hands off time. And there's something really key about prayer and meditation in that too. You have to take your hands off time. You have to realise that the world isn't there to be shaped by you, but you need to let yourself be shaped.
And jazz especially, but I think a lot of musicians have a faith that drives them as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot, you know, I was talking to you before we started about my love of John Coltrane, and one of my favourites is A Love Supreme, and the liner notes for that are incredible.
That's it. Well, there's a book here, God's Mind in That Music. Theological Explorations through the Music of John Coltrane. And this one, this is an amazing work. Jason Bivens, this is Jazz and American Religion. And this is a really, really fabulous read. So both of these are really, really cool.
Okay, I'm going to take photographs of both of those in a moment.
There's a lot here, but I think those two are really good. This study by Bivens is excellent. Jazz and American Religion.
Because... I mean, I'm not going to ask you about your drug taking, but, you know, there's a lot of those guys.
It would be a fairly short answer, I'm afraid. It's a bit boring.
probably quite dull. There's a lot about that where spirituality fits within music, and where people seek that spirituality in drugs. You know, a lot of that, especially in the 60s, you know, all of those guys that were... taking stuff all the time. I think probably some of my compatriots would say about the 80s when that was happening, and it's really interesting. I'm going to get both of those and I'm going to look at
they're
those
both so good. They're a good read.
Yes, fantastic. So what does the future hold musically? I mean, talk to me about some of the gigs that you've got coming up, which you
so part of it is that well, we moved to Cambridge in 2020 for me to take up this job, so it was COVID, and it was a part-time job here, and then, of course, there was no music.
No.
But gradually, there's a kind of a sustainable local working life here. So I teach about 15 students a week. I play at the University Arms on Regent Street, which is a hotel. I share that gig with a great tenor player called Sam Miles, and we do, like, week on, week off. He's amazing. Everybody should listen to him. Plays with Tom Green Septet.
Oh,
lovely
okay.
guy, great player.
Right.
So we do kind of a week each that. I run jazz at The Lab, which is a cocktail bar on Regent Street. I was saying I played there last night, and we have some great British jazz artists coming there. And then, you know, we've got a really exciting jazz program about to start here at Girton. So watch this space.
Oh, that's
Can't
exciting.
Can't say much more at the moment, but that is... is going to be pioneering, hopefully, within the university scene and also for us. So that's really cool, involved in that. The aim with these suites really is to expand this as a way of kind of carving my own path a little bit. So I do lots of standards gigs, and that's great. I love it. I've got sort of my own arrangements, and you end up with your own sets that you like. I do, play lots of jazz clubs and things like that around the place. But in terms of the more original stuff like Psalter and the other two suites, I'm doing a gig in Newcastle Cathedral. We're actually with my predecessor from here, who's a poet, so we're playing my suite and his poetry in between.
The
hope is to open up a bit of that cathedral circuit, but we also play these suites anyway, you know. I think at the moment the future is to be really glad that a regular jazz scene has opened up here. You know, I've got two children, life is full, and it's really nice not to be travelling all over the place to play all the time. I like playing locally, it's fun. Cambridge is a pretty happy place to play jazz. The people are nice, the scene's nice. And then to expand these kind of theological-ish jazz suites, and then to press into that academically a bit. So I'm a theologian academically, and I've always been a bit careful about going in the theology and jazz direction because it feels like it's too precious, but I think that's sort of about to start.
Right, yeah. Well, certainly these two books are exactly that, aren't they?
So yeah, they are.
I think there's a big question about jazz and faith, you know, and that can mean a lot of different things to different people.
Yeah, it can. So. I mean, you know, I could talk about it for ages. There's a couple of things that I'm really interested in that. One is quite a specific question, which has been approached by a few people, but I'm sort of perhaps trying to come at it from a slightly different perspective. And that is about the resemblance between the way jazz musicians improvise and the way communities read sacred texts.
Okay.
So to try and move away from the idea that a text has a sealed final meaning, right? The standards we play don't have a sealed final meaning. It's collaborative, but we also need an expression of that piece or of that text that fits time, place, you know, that this is where it parts its ways a bit. But in terms of sacred text, people speak in terms of authority in some kind of way that can sound a bit overbearing, and perhaps we need a better word. But also, you know, there's a kind of authority behind the standards too, you know, like Satin Doll is always Ellington's, right?
Right.
So,
well,
So I'm interested in that, you know, that relationship between what jazz musicians do and what communities do with sacred text. And I'm interested in pressing into that in a practical way. So not just writing about it as a metaphor, but actually doing it. And that's what these suites are, you know. Okay, let's take text that everybody knows, like the Christmas story, and do the reading, and then play a piece of jazz. Now what happens for you? What does this text mean now? Does it open up a new direction? And then the other thing I think that I find really interesting for myself is thinking about meaning as a whole. And people say, you know, music speaks louder than words. And that's probably because it doesn't, if that makes sense. It's because it doesn't try and do what words do. And so again, we're trying to move away from that very tightly defined thing. It doesn't really help us to be in this world with the idea that in order to flourish we need to be able to define and understand everything. I don't think that's very helpful.
No, and actually I think that's what I think is wonderful about faith and about theology, is that, you know, this has been, particularly the Christian faith, has been going on for more than 2,000 years, and we're still answering and asking questions.
Yeah, and we have a responsibility to do so.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. It can be evasive sometimes to think that the meaning of this is sealed and we simply have to apply it. You know, not to get into theology too much, but that, you know, even a cursory reading of the New Testament will show you that that's not really the kind of thing that Jesus did. You know, walked around going, right, you know, that's how it's always been. In fact, it's completely other from that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's fascinating, and I sense that we could carry on with this conversation for a long, long time. One of the things that I did want to talk to you about is the work that you do quite a lot with James.
James Pearson. Yes.
Because he is he's one of the people that I want to get on this podcast because his father was married. His father's first wife was my piano teacher.
Okay.
And so James's half sister is a really good friend of mine who was her daughter, and so I feel I feel a real kinship with him, which is really quite interesting. But he's a fantastic pianist.
Isn't he? World. Yeah, I mean, James is a true crossover. So, you know, he's a genuine classical performer and exceptional jazz pianist. So for people who don't know, he's the artistic director of Ronnie Scott's in Soho, which of course is probably the most iconic jazz club in the UK. One of the most iconic in Europe, if not the world, really. So James is the artistic director there. He's just got the most incredibly broad palette as a pianist. He's a real expert in the styles of, you know, the whole range. In fact, I think there's a, like, the history of jazz piano in 3 minutes or something.
That's
on YouTube,
right.
Which,
yes.
You can,
yes.
Which you can get.
And yes.
So, yeah, how did I meet James? I met James through Polly Gibbons, who's a singer. They work together a lot. And I think I met Polly playing at something for her, playing piano for her, which I think James was supposed to do. So I was able to do it instead, which was a great for me, but, you know, yeah. probably a bit of a downer for Polly. anyway, so that was fun, and then we ended up doing a couple of things together, which was lovely. And then I asked him to play at something here, and then this question arose through a couple of my colleagues here at Girton of, look, this guy, what he does and how he does it seems to fit really well with here. So we invited James to become a musician in residence. I think we're the only Cambridge college with a jazz musician in residence. James pops up here fairly regularly to do things at Girton, for Girton. And as I say, opening out jazz here in ways that I'll be non-specific about at the moment.
Of course.
have him very involved too. We did a gig at Cambridge Jazz Festival, Oscar Peterson and the Saxophones. So we picked up the albums that Oscar recorded with Sonny Stitt, Ben Webster, Zoot Sims and Lester Young. I mean, he did a few more, but those are four really iconic ones, and we played through that kind of stuff, which is lovely.
Yeah.
And then we've also got this thing going on, which is really fun, which I'm starting to call the jazz of your life. So the idea is, it's like a bespoke personal concert for somebody who sends in their life story, and we design a set around, you know, the places they've lived and the dates when important things happen. So we've got one of those coming up in a few days.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and the energy's great.
Yeah.
And it's lovely for me. And he was absolutely the right guy to play Psalter.
Yes.
The other two suites, though, have another astonishing pianist on, Phil Merriman, who people should look up, and is a wonderful guy. Also involved in churches and presses into this whole relationship between jazz and faith, and is a masterful player, and again really has a hold on the kind of thing I'm trying to do through these suites. But yeah, the work with James is great fun, and it's getting more frequent, which is lovely for me.
Yeah.
We're playing Psalter in Cambridge on the 20th of September for the St Paul's Arts Festival.
Right, I think I shall have to come to that, because I loved listening to it the first time, and it feels like a suite that will give more as you listen to it more.
That's the plan, and again, that's the kind of thing that texts do.
Yes.
So, I think, I mean, I'm always interested to know where it's going to go next time. I guess the one thing, this was the first time we'd performed it. I said to you, we all played it for the first time the morning. We had We had the crypt in St Albans Cathedral for the day, and we just, you know, sort of tea and biscuits down, and we just explored it. Because I hadn't heard it. When I write on piano, and then I sketch it out and write charts, but I don't program them into a computer.
Wow.
Or anything, so I don't hear it until the day, and that's quite important. And there was one piece I thought, actually, this has taken shape, you know, we're almost there, but there's one more step that needs to happen, so I'll reshape that a little bit.
Wow. But
yeah, then the rest of the way it develops will be, one, the way that jazz always develops, like that when musicians come to material a few times, you bed in, you dig into it a bit more, you start to really uncover the bits of the piece that are inviting you to really do your thing in your specific way, and you get under the skin of the composer a little bit. But also, I'd like to think that playing those texts, so that the musicians have the verse in front of them as well as the chord changes and the shape. So I'm always instructing them that, you know, we are playing this verse, you know, this is what we're doing. Explore this.
Yeah.
Explore these words. And I think, particularly with the other two that I've done, you know, we're now on the sort of 20th whatever playing of it. Yeah, actually, you've got under the skin of the text a bit more too.
Wow, that's amazing. That's fantastic. Well, we've come full circle from starting talking about Psalter to finishing talking about Psalter. I will make sure that in the show notes there are links to all of these people we've talked about, all of the things that we've talked about, so that people can follow those rabbit holes all the way through. So, because that's one of the nice things I think about, well, actually, I was about to say about jazz, but it's also about theology, isn't it? About faith, is that it takes you in different directions that can sometimes be quite surprising.
They can be, and challenging too. And I think one thing just to say is sometimes this is an idealised relationship. You know, faith and theology just fit so beautifully. But, you know, there are catastrophic human failings in religion and in life, in the arts, and so it's important that we don't do this with an idealist kind of frame, but actually say the way we do this needs to be aware of our failings, our capacity to do one another great harm, as well as great good, and to explore and inhabit the arts, you know, in a way that is aware of that and is trying to say, well, you know, how can we willingly try to shape ourselves towards a more just way of living alongside one another.
Fantastic. As you know, this is called Harmonious World, and that's from a Quincy Jones quote, which says, imagine what a harmonious world it would be if we all shared a little of what we're good at. So thank you for sharing a little of what you're good at.
It's a delight to have a chat. It's really lovely.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation with saxist Tim Boniface at his study in the wonderful Girton College, Cambridge. What you're listening to now is the eighth word, taken from the eight words, Tim's Easter suite. You can also find the infant, which is his Christmas suite. And hopefully, in the not too distant future, Psalter Themes for Peace, which was premiered at St Albans Cathedral in January 2024, will also be available. But thank you for joining me once more for Harmonious World, and I hope your Easter weekend and any holiday that you have around now is very pleasant. Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Harmonious World. My name is Hilary Seabrook, and it's a great delight to bring this series of discussions with musicians and composers and writers and all sorts of people to you. Obviously, there's no point in having a podcast if people aren't listening, and I'm very grateful to my listeners for doing so. Thanks also to Joe English for composing and performing this new theme tune. So wherever you get your podcast, you can leave a review. You can share this with your friends and family, either as a link or on social media and that sort of thing. I'd be really grateful for that. Don't forget that you can subscribe now. There's a link wherever you get your podcasts. So have a great week, and please remember why I started this, which is just to try and make the world a little more harmonious. Thanks for listening to Harmonious World.